Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with the Reason Podcast, and today we're talking with Reason's Matt Welch, editor-at-large, longtime editor of the print magazine, who has been following every campaign like nobody's business this election season. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and I'm proud to tell you that I am at the San Luis Valley Regional Airport in Alamosa, Colorado. Elevation 7,900 feet.
All right. So the brownies you're baking are going to take extra long, something like that, right? That's always been a dream
exactly.
of mine, to cook something at altitude and finally get to follow the high altitude directions.
The most important thing is that to realize that even if a half an hour has elapsed, that doesn't mean that they won't take effect.
Yes. We are hours in the dozens of hours away from figuring out who won tomorrow's or the election 2016's rigged contest between Hillary Trump and Donald Clinton. I'm batshit on this. You have been following Gary Johnson in particular, and you just came from a rally he did in San Diego. Give us an update on how is the campaign feeling, what's the vibe in the crowd, that sort of thing.
Well, it was actually at the Colorado Christian University in Lakewood, Colorado, there yesterday, and 2 days before that I was in Sacramento in a wonderful Indian restaurant called the Mirage. The campaign has gotten into a kind of a giddy, punch-drunk phase, you can say, as Gary Johnson's daughter, Saya, and I'm probably mispronouncing her name, pointed out in Sacramento on Friday. They've been waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning and kind of running it until midnight, and you can see the fumes coming out, some red eyes, and she has a wrap in there because she's a beekeeper as well as her brother, and she talks about how bees, when they have found a particularly great little bit of pollen somewhere, they come back to the hive and they express this information by dancing. And then the other bees start dancing, and so she encourages everyone out there to start dancing. And then when Gary Johnson comes out, he goes, we're dancing.
As it happens, I was just reading about the ghost dance movement that took place in that part of the country in the late 1800s, where as a kind of rebuke to the power of the U.S. government, Indians started dancing as a way of warding off the evilness of the federal government. Is it working? Is it working, Matt?
I think that is that extended metaphor writes itself. Yeah. That's very beautiful. It's an interesting split, right? And this gets to something that I'll be writing about in the next couple of days, and Brian Doherty and I will be writing about the print magazine as we kind of go through an autopsy of the campaign. People on the inside of the campaign are, as close to the inside as possible in the campaign, have the same questions about it as all us kind of outsider observers do. The kind of Goldilocks question of, hey, is this the greatest they've, exceeded previous results by, probably quadruple? Is this the greatest thing ever? Is this just a crushing, terrible disappointment, considering how high they were in the polls? Is it somewhere in between? They don't know either. And one of the great splits on that is the difference between longtime libertarian activists, whether they're in the LP or just people who, like you, have been in the broader libertarian movement for three decades. Their perspective versus the perspective of the normals on the outside, and no one really knows, right? And then this keeps coming up. And the way that it expresses itself at rallies is interesting, because the organizers of the event, they want to immediately go off with you, send everything off the record, and start talking about William Weld.
Yeah. So, first, what do you think? I mean, is it liberty's greatest triumph, or the Libertarian Party's greatest triumph, or is it, as a lot of concerned trolls who are liberals and conservatives who, have no interest in libertarian ideas are like, you guys missed a real opportunity by not aping whatever I wanted out of you. Is this, is the campaign, and let's assume he gets somewhere between 4% and 6%. Of the vote, or even 3% of the national vote, is it a success or a failure?
I think that ultimately it is a success. It's a mixed Goldilocks bag.
And by here. Goldilocks, you mean it's this is the bowl of porridge that is just right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's not just right because everyone wanted it to do better.
Right.
But in the mix of things, and one of the reasons why I think that ultimately it should be judged as a success and a disappointment at the same time, and I think it's possible to hold both those things, is partly what you see at the rallies. The people in the audience are jazzed, and those audiences are bigger than audiences that they've seen ever before. I was talking yesterday with Karen Ann Harlos, who's a great, if anyone has been to LP events and seen a gal with pink hair and a Statue of Liberty headdress. That's Karen. She's a senior member of the LP in Colorado and is on the Radical Caucus here. And we were kind of talking about the same issue yesterday. And she's like, hey, look, you know, we have so many more people than before. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you can sit there and complain that, hey, these people don't understand about the non-aggression principle or whatever kind of longstanding libertarian thing. And she says, look, it's a great opportunity to have those conversations. We wouldn't have been able to have those conversations before. Talking yesterday with Judge Jim Gray, the 2012 vice presidential nominee, a guy who wanted to be the vice presidential nominee this time around, but then stepped aside when they had the opportunity to get Bill Weld. And I asked him the question that we're all asking is, you know, is it a success? Is it a failure? Why and why not? And he had a very, and I said, what's the best thing that happened, right? What's the thing that went most right? And he had a very surprising to me answer, which was Bill Weld was the thing that went most right. And you think, hey, you know, this guy would be jealous, first of all.
Yeah, so let's talk about that because Bill Weld.
His argument.
Yeah, just to set the table briefly, Bill Weld, of course, the vice presidential candidate, two-term former Republican governor of Massachusetts, almost an ambassador to Mexico, socially liberal, fiscally conservative, and a dear friend of Hillary Clinton who got into trouble for saying, hey, you know what, I'm vouching for her with Rachel Maddow. So Jim Gray, what's his argument that Bill Weld is the greatest thing since sliced white bread, which he kind of resembles?
As soon as Weld was mentioned that Gary Johnson wanted to have him as his vice president, which happened in mid-May, 2 weeks before the Libertarian Convention, Weld immediately got on 24 national TV broadcasts to talk about the Libertarian Party ticket. That, you know, that's almost 24 more than Jim Gray got in the entire cycle last time, right? So he immediately he brought them, according to this argument, which I think has definite validity, he immediately raised their floor to a level in which then you can be disappointed later in what happens and his actions. But we should not take it for granted that they would have been even polled. If you go back to 2012, there's less than 10 national polls that ever included Gary Johnson's name. Seriously, go back and look at them. There's almost no polling. And here there are hundreds of polls. It became the norm pretty early in the cycle to have that. Part of that is the Weld effect.
Yeah.
Now, of course,
we can also say that, Judge Jim Gray, who is particularly phenomenal on the issue of drug policy and whatnot, is massively articulate about, you know, criminal justice reform, drug policy, government spending, government action. I mean, he is a phenomenal spokesman. And to your point, he does not have the reputation or the ability to open doors like Bill Weld did. Now, do you think that Bill Weld ultimately, so, you know, and I know you've written about this, I've written about this a bit, is Bill Weld, was he a net positive or negative on the campaign? And do libertarians need to understand that if you want to run candidates who might actually get big votes, you're going to have to, think about things a little bit differently than whether or not they believe that driver's licenses are, you know, an affront to liberty that cannot stand?
I'll take an interesting dodge on this in that, yes, for the reasons I said before, he immediately raised the floor on what was possible. And so that has to be seen as a net positive. And the fact that they're getting close to 5%, hopefully they'll get through, but it's not necessarily likely at this point. But he is definitely part of that story. He spent this weekend on Jay Tapper, you know, talking about a Libertarian Party ticket. That is not something that happens previously. However, at the same time, his kind of betrayal, and I think that he acted in a very poor fashion on Rachel Maddow, in that there's one thing to be said of like, hey, I know her, and it's unfair the way people are treating her, and as my experience as a former U.S. attorney, James Comey is acting weird. All of those are totally valid points, and you could say, damn, he went further by saying, I'm here vouching for her, and then he talked about her honesty, and I just don't think that you can, as a competitor, and then as just someone who's analyzing the situation, describe her acts as it involves the email server as honesty. And he also threw the LP under the bus at that moment because he disagreed with a statement that they put out kind of under his name about the Comey thing. So the fact that a broad spectrum of libertarians, not just LP activists, not just the radical caucus, but a lot of people who maybe only themselves have considered themselves to be a small L libertarian semi-recently, the fact that they all kind of rose up in revulsion against this act, in a weird way, by smiting Bill Weld, they're either making the movement stronger or they're reflecting the resilience of it and the breadth of it. Think about it this way. Ross Perot, this is the inverse Ross Perot, right? Ross Perot, the party was created around him, this cult of personality, and as much as he was in it, it was popular, and then when he withdrew, it ended up kind of collapsing. The Libertarian Party is kind of the reverse of this. It's not because of Gary Johnson's fantastic charisma that we're seeing the party go from 0.4% when Bob Barr was running to 1% last time to 4% this time. It's actually the party itself, as you know from talking with Nicholas Sarwark and other people, they are gaining at the state and local level, they are gaining members, they're gaining money and all these types of things.
And can I just stick up a little bit for Gary Johnson's charisma or lack thereof? It is, he is not necessarily, and he's the first person to say this, he is not a soothsayer. If he has to tell a good story to save his own life, put him at the front of the line because he's going to be dispatched right away. But the fact is that Gary brings credibility. And again, we do have a kind of natural experiment of him running in 2012 versus 2016. But he's, he knows what he's talking about. And when he's prepared, he's pretty good. And I suspect that in Colorado, he was getting the crowd pretty wound up. I know I saw him at the end of the 2012 campaign at an event in Cincinnati where he brought a crowd of 500, 600 people to their feet legitimately. It wasn't a fake standing up.
That is definitely happening. What I mean kind of about the charisma effect is more like it's not a cult of personality around Gary Johnson. We see this in libertarian circles. I mean, it's one of the main differences between Rand Paul and Ron Paul. I think Ron Paul, the fan base for him, oftentimes borders on and crosses the borders into a cult of personality. What did the great man say? You never saw that with Rand Paul. In fact, you saw a lot of the Ron Paul people kind of be the first ones to plunge the blade with Rand. And this is a recurring phenomenon, I think, in libertarianism, kind of starting with Ayn Rand and going down the pike of, even though it's this great individualist ethos, people get really hung up on individuals and totems and things like that. That's not the case here. So the case here is a more of a just like a genuine appreciation for the guy. They're coming out for him. They are fond of him in ways, and it's very interesting that they kind of create this separation between Gary Johnson and Bill Weld in that way. They are pretty similar guys. I take the separation myself too. I mean, I'm super fond of Gary Johnson, and I more appreciate the cunning of Bill Weld, but hold him at arm's length. And I don't know if that's a West to East Coast kind of thing as well.
May be a big part of it, that they're the Tupac and Biggie of libertarianism, East Coast, West Coast libertarianism.
I admitted to him, he and I took a, Gary Johnson and I took a Sella train from D.C. 2 weeks ago, and it had been at a long day full of events.
Now, did you insist on paying not just the stated fare, but the taxpayer subsidy, so that you were not ripping off the taxpayer?
No.
Okay.
Did not do that. And we were just kind of chilling out rather than being in a serious interview context, because Lord knows I've interviewed him a few times over the past few months. But it was actually kind of interesting to see him with his guard down. Dude sits there and plays chess by him against the computer over and over again, and loses. He's lost every time for 2 years, which is a kind of an odd stick-to-itiveness.
Please tell me it's not like a computer from 1945 or something either. That is, is at a 6-year-old child's level or something?
No, because he had me play against it. It's the last thing in the world I wanted to do, because it was just like it was humiliation in about 35 seconds while he was smirking at me. But I confessed to him that, one of the stock stories that Bill Weld's wife, I believe it's his wife, maybe fiance, tells, and she's a very funny writer, is that, Bill was proud of himself by beating people at chess blindfolded, two games at once and this kind of stuff. And when Gary Johnson came out to hang out, they played chess, and Weld thought that he was going to wipe the floor with him, and Johnson slaughtered him like twice. I had to confess through my own kind of West Coast thing, like, hey, you know what? I'm kind of glad if one of you bastards is going to even play chess that you'd beat him, because screw Boston.
All right. You're not going to get much of an argument. Boston is, if you're from the East Coast at all, and by East Coast, I mean everything west of Kansas or east of Kansas, Boston is part of England or something, or Canada. Nobody likes it.
That's why Michael Moynihan talks about that accent.
Yeah, it's like it's not an accent. It's really a speech impediment, but we don't need to talk about that right now, because the Republic is in dire straits here. Is the LP committed to running more candidates like Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, in that, is there a shift that has been made that people are comfortable with and that the leadership is behind, of saying, we're not running informational campaigns anymore, strictly informational campaigns. We're actually going to put forth people who can make a difference in electoral politics at all levels?
That will be a very disputed thing beginning as soon as the next time, I think the next LP convention is in 2018. My hunch here is that it's going to be something in between your kind of Gary Johnson, Bill Weld type, and let's say a polished homegrown libertarian. There's a lot of conversation about this at the LP convention. I mean, Austin Peterson, love him or hate him, has figured out how to talk in front of crowds and to talk on television and these types of things. Larry Sharp, who was the ultimately the biggest competitor to Bill Weld as vice president, came very close to winning, doesn't have a long resume in politics, but is like a motivational speaker. He's incredibly well-versed in ideas of liberty, and is a really effective communicator. So what I think you'll see is, yes, you'll have a more of a politician-style person, but they will be people who are not as, like, recent former Republicans or recent former Democrats. That's just a hunch.
Go ahead. Well, now we're chippendaling here, right? After you, Alphonse. It's going to be hard for them, probably just because there aren't that many around, right, to get somebody with the resume of either Weld or Johnson, much less two of them on the same ticket. But then, there are certain types of businessmen or entrepreneurs or, as you're talking about, kind of public figures, which – kind of leads to the next thing I wanted to talk with you about, because while you were traveling the Intermountain West, you also did a great interview, which is up at Reason.com, with Evan McMullen and his vice presidential candidate, Mindy Finn. And McMullen is having an outsized impact in a couple places, particularly Utah, and he fits that bill, where he's an ex-CIA agent and a Republican staffer, but hasn't held any offices, but presents well. Tell us a little bit about your impressions of Evan McMullen and Mindy Finn, and why are they doing so well in Utah?
I would like to say that I would like to not go to the obvious answer of that. Well, he's from Utah. He's from Provo. Mm-hmm. He's Mormon in a year where the GOP kind of revulsion at Donald Trump has been led by Mormons, but that is the most obvious answer, and I think it's true. I mean, Mike Lee has been kind of the center of the opposition. He hasn't come out and endorsed a third-party candidate, but he said early on, I am not here for Trump. And at the Republican convention, he kind of led the revolt against right. him.
Jeff Flake also did something similar, where he is essentially, Jeff Flake, who's the senator from Arizona, is Mormon, not obviously from Utah, but has strong ties and is publicly, is a public Mormon, has also denounced Trump or said he refuses to vote for him.
Yeah, and when the groping Access Hollywood tape came out, Senator Mike Crapo, I don't even know if that's pronounced correctly.
It is Crapo, but in our hearts we know it's Crapo.
He and Congressman Jason Chaffetz from Utah mm-hmm. and a few other people at that moment said, okay, I can't do this. They since went back.
Yeah.
Once the Trump polling came in, and those are the people that McMullen and Finn are really targeting their wrath on in their kind of stump speech. I was really surprised when I saw them give their rap in St. George, Utah on Saturday. I was surprised the extent to which their selling points was about the Declaration of Independence, not our book, although they right. channeled it on occasion. But the original declaration, particularly that all men and
you mean the rough draft of our book, the one written by those weirdos
yeah.
A couple hundred years ago.
That all men and women, as mm-hmm. McMullen always put in, are created equal. They talked about their vision of a new conservatism. And it's important to point out this is not a new libertarianism. This right. is a new conservatism. Puts liberty and equality at the center of it. And they kept talking about it. That they are they're referring very openly to Donald Trump's bigotry, to his vulgar behavior and collectivism towards minorities. And they are visibly just kind of appalled by that behavior. And they stress that stuff so much more than just about anything else. The other thing they stressed was states' rights and allowing local decisions on a variety of things, whether it's education, whether it's land use, which is a big deal in Utah,
right.
and other things. And those, that's always been pretty popular in Utah. But they're just hitting pluralism, equality, like a kind of a decency over and over again.
And there are
some speech much more than national security.
And we'll get, let me ask with the pluralism stuff, because the stuff that I've heard from McMullen in various things is that he seems to be pretty socially, I wouldn't say socially liberal, but he is socially tolerant. Where is he on things like abortion and gay marriage? Because the Mormon Church got into a lot of trouble for actually secretly funding anti-gay marriage initiatives in California and whatnot. Have they sued and made peace with the idea that abortion is going to be legal and that gay marriage is a done deal? How do they talk about that? And then also with the vulgarity question with somebody like Trump, is it that he's vulgar or kind of crass, which he is. And in another way of saying that is that he's kind of an articulation or a personification of New York in a lot of ways. Is it that he's crass and vulgar, or is it that he is bigoted? And that's what's turning people off.
It's that. I mean, that he treats people badly
mm-hmm.
in a rude fashion based on their status of birth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is unacceptable. That is not what conservatism should be all about. Or on their mm-hmm. religious status. That's also a very important thing, obviously, to Mormons. So, one of the bigger applause lines was like, my God, he did say my God, but we shouldn't have religious tests in this country.
Right.
And for reasons that make a lot of sense. They are, to answer your question, pro-life. They do foreground that. And, a culture of life, they talk about that. Didn't dwell on it, but
mm-hmm.
that's definitely part of their vision there on gay marriage. And I didn't ask him directly about a couple of issues that I would have liked to. Gay marriage is one, but drug war more importantly.
What,
he's kind of snickered at Gary Johnson in the past on this stuff.
What
but
did
his
he
position
say
on gay marriage?
Oh, I'm sorry.
In the past, he's sort of like, oh, Gary Johnson just talks about being stoned all the time. That kind of stupid repartee. But on gay marriage, his counsel has been, hey, let's move on. Let's stop making politics about this.
Mm-hmm.
So it is that suing for peace kind of idea much more than it is, much more than their position on, pro-life and protecting life would be. And it obviously hasn't been a big part of their campaign. His mother, by press accounts, is remarried to a woman.
Right.
And there was a nasty white supremacist named Bill Johnson who was sending around robocalls insinuating that McMullen is a closeted gay and that his mom's or your mom's a bunch of lesbians and this kind of stuff. My feeling in being in the crowd, and it was interesting to be there physically because on the outside there was probably about 40 pro-Trump protesters picketing the thing with Trump signs and kind of heckling and people as they're coming in. And this is compared to maybe 250 people inside the room. And the age gap was staggering. I mean, probably the median age of the pro-Trump people was about 65. And they're just kind of cackling at people. And then on the inside, I would say the median age is more like 35. There was at least a dozen children just kind of crawling around and running around. It speaks to a generation gap. And his polling, the extent to which they've broken it out by age, it mirrors Gary Johnson throughout the country. Mm. It's millennials first by a huge margin. And I think part of that is just the basic tolerance message. We've talked about this a lot, and our Reason Root poll kind of highlighted this fact. The political value held by millennials in this country is not about, Bernie Sanders socialism. Right. It's not about this. It's not about that. It's about not being a bigot. It's that. If you are associated with that, you will lose forever.
How is, in the interview you did with McMullen and his running mate, which is up at Reason.com and is really worth a read, it's pretty eye-opening because he's even critical of the Iraq war and whatnot. And even though he has served overseas, he doesn't come across as a super hawk, certainly not in the way that Hillary Clinton is or that Trump is intermittently. But so you said, I mean, he's stressing this is a new conservatism, not a new libertarianism. What is the essential thing that keeps him from being libertarian, or is he one but can't quite acknowledge it?
Well, he's closer to Hillary Clinton on foreign policy than he'll let on. He attempts to make the kind of false choice between that. We're veering between invading every country all the time and, being completely isolationist. Mm-hmm. It's like, but we're not. And he holds on to what I think can be a fiction at times of, if we just intervene early here, we can stop the bad things from spreading and it'll save money in the long run. Maybe, maybe not also. And we kind of got into that a little bit in the interview. So he is more of a hawk. He does stress it wasn't in his stump speech, but I've seen him talk about it before. The military has been cut to the bone. You need to restore our defense.
The latest thing I read is that we have, only a fraction of the airplanes that the Continental Army had in the 1770s. So it is really pretty bad.
So it's that stuff definitely keeping him from it. From being, and I'm sure it's pro-life, mm-hmm. abortion being part of it. He did talk about he mentioned criminal justice reform as an important value to hold. He has said in several interviews, and he tried to say it with me, but I actually didn't want to talk about it because it would have wasted time. But he has said, like, if Gary Johnson was a real libertarian, I wouldn't be running.
Yeah.
I don't think that's true. I think that he means if Austin Peterson had been running, because Austin Peterson is a pro-life, which is rare in the LP. Yeah. He's a pro-life libertarian, and he just sort of comes across as more of of the deep voiced, libertarian you could take home to your conservative mom. I think he would be that type of libertarian. But when he sees the weirdos, when he sees the pink hair and the Statue of Liberty hats and people talking about weed all the time, he thinks that they're fundamentally unserious and especially unserious about foreign policy.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing, I think, that keeps a lot of our friends who are conservatives who are friendly influence with libertarianism and write for us plenty of times. But I think there are elements about libertarianism that keeps them kind of permanently from pulling the lever. And those things are abortion, usually interventionism or national defense, and kind of some incohate like distancing from the weirdos who are smoking pot all the time.
So let's we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. Let's talk about the Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America, which is the book that you and I co-authored in 2011, paperback with the new edition in 2012. Our essential thesis was that the same kind of breakdown of big duopolies or kind of semi-monopolies and cartels in all parts of our lives, where you could only be male or female, where you could only buy Kodak or Fujifilm, where you could only, you know, there were a couple of car companies you could buy from, et cetera, all airlines you could fly. What has happened over the past 40 or so years has been this vast libertarian moment where people are have more individualized and personalized choices in all aspects of their lives except politics, because change always comes last to politics. In a lot of ways, and I have to admit I was slow to acknowledge that we called a lot of stuff in writings that for between, you know, that we've done going back to at least 2008, saying, you know what, the duopoly in politics is breaking down. Do you see the 2016 election as evidence that, you know, we are really onto something, and that this is not a process where, you know, we look at the Democrats and the Republicans are at or near historic lows in terms of voter identification? They have put up the two most disliked candidates, disapproved candidates, hated candidates in, you know, in recorded history. Are we onto something? And if so, what comes next?
I think definitely yes, and I say that my default is to assume that I'm wrong on most everything.
That's a default that you share with me. I assume that you're wrong on most things as well.
Yeah, that was clear. Go and read the last three paragraphs of the McMullen interview. It's as if he's quoting from our book. I mean, mm-hmm. He's talking about duopolies, the way that they behave. He's talking about how fewer people are identifying and registering with political parties, and that millennials are effectively unaffiliated, and that itself is just kind of ripe for changing the life cycles of political parties. I mean, mm-hmm. It's pretty deck of indie stuff. I would add the caveat that what has surprised me the most about the election, besides all of the obviously surprising things, has been the extent to which there's kind of like ghost architecture that's keeping this thing in place long after there's no enthusiasm for it anymore. And that stuff, the ghost architecture, lives in people's brains as much as it is stuff like just totally manufactured duopoly behavior, like the access to presidential debates or ballot access. That's just, you know, that is totally terrible, rude behavior on the part of the duopoly holding power. But I mean, think about the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans for America. They had a kind of pre-debate debate in September. Gary Johnson has been polling better than Hillary Clinton among active duty military pretty consistently throughout this campaign. And so this organization that's all about veterans and active duty military held an event and wouldn't invite him, because there is this kind of two-party thinking in your head, even if there's evidence in front of you. Look at all of the, you're right, I mean, these reviled candidates. How many of these, even Jeff Flakes or Mike Lees, sure, they've said they won't vote for their candidate, but how many of those people have said, you know what, you should vote for this other one here? And not just, I mean, it's harder for a sitting politician. But how many newspapers
I totally
a
agree.
Third party candidate, nine,
which is pretty great, especially when you look at a paper like the Chicago Tribune, which is by its own acclaim, and why who would challenge it? It's the world's greatest newspaper. But you know, it is something. And then I was going to say, you also have that architecture that's built in of, you know, Jay-Z and Beyonce singing songs in front of Hillary Clinton that she would have been lobbying to censor 20 years ago, or we're saying, you know, we're as bad as video games and whatnot. So you have that of this weird kind of adulation from celebrities who are, you know, I mean, they can't give a shit about Hillary Clinton. They can't. I mean, and as much as Donald Trump may be a nightmare for them. It's a weird kind of repetitive stress disorder where they're just going through the motions of something.
It's the open question is, how much do people conclude that this year was not an aberration in terms of the awfulness of the candidates, but it's the logical conclusion of the trajectory of both parties and of the way that the duopoly has run itself. And I think, yeah, there's some black swans that have been mixed into a Donald Trump, certainly. But go back and look at the modern trajectory of the GOP on immigration policy. Mitt Romney was the biggest immigration hawk there. I mean, they've been playing with this stuff. They've been stirring it up. And this is something that Mindy Finn in particular said in our interview, and I think she's right. Trump's been bad. He's been stirring it up and waving the wand. But this has been brewing for a really long time, and it's been brewing on the Democratic side as well in terms of this just magical thinking about we can regulate and tax our way to prosperity. Hillary Clinton at this point is running against her own economics from 8 years ago, which were already well to the left of where Bill Clinton had been in the 90s. And there's no penalty associated with just pretending that the $20 trillion debt doesn't exist and that we can expand entitlements somehow in this atmosphere. So this is the logical conclusion. And as voters are completely turned off, repulsed by what they've seen, question is, will that repulsion be permanent? Will they start demanding anything from the outside coming in? It's a fool's game to make too many predictions. But the fact that particularly the large millennial cohort out there, even though they'll vote for Hillary Clinton much more than Donald Trump, but the fact that they are unaffiliated and kind of up for grabs and just don't understand belonging in the same ways makes the situation volatile. And even though there is this ghost architecture, it means that we're going to be having these kind of explosions. That's going to be permanent, I think.
Well, here, though, let me just challenge you on that, because I agree with you, and I love the idea of the ghost architecture where, you know, the voices in our heads who are saying, no, we got to keep doing things the way we were taught or something, even when we're, you know, we have terrible, terrible freedom. When do we start saying, okay, millennials may not want to call themselves Democrats, but they voted, you know, essentially 100% for Barack Obama twice, albeit in lesser numbers the second time around. Overwhelmingly going to vote. I mean, Donald Trump might have negative numbers among millennials. And, you know, at what point do we say, okay, they're not willing to call themselves Democrats, but they have consistently voted their entire lives for Democrats in a way that if you go back to 2000, I mean, it's kind of amazing. And obviously that was an election that was a total decided by a coin flip, essentially. But, you know, the gender gap, the number of Latinos who were voting for Republicans, the age gap, there wasn't an age gap, really. Whereas now all the only votes Republicans reliably get are the people who are about to die, and then, of course, will vote Democratic once they're actually buried. But, when do we say, or what do we need to do? And by we, I mean you and me, and I mean libertarians, and I mean the Libertarian Party, and people who want a different future for the country. What do we need to do to get millennials to say, you know what, the Democratic Party, yeah, they're offering us all kinds of free shit, but that is no way forward. That's actually more of the same.
I think one of the largest reasons why you've seen those voting numbers the way you have, and you will again this year, is that too much of our politics is now pretty explicitly about race or about groups. Mm-hmm. And that's on both sides. And I mean, they become these funhouse mirror images of one another. Trump made it explicit this time in a way that it was kind of unprecedented since George Wallace or Richard Nixon or something like that. But, when it's organized around race and these people hold as their primary and in some cases sole political value that they don't want to be bigoted, these are the results that you're going to get. But they're also going to be disappointed by the other things that they want to see happen. They're going to vote for Hillary Clinton, although she hates Uber, she hates the sharing economy, she hates a lot of the stuff that they like. Her policies are going to fail because they're terrible. And so I think it is pointing out that that she will be, and certainly has been up until this point, a complete disappointment and a terror, actually, on issues that they care about in terms of civil liberties, free expression, and war, and criminal justice reform, and that, meanwhile, her economics won't work, and they suck, even though you might agree with a minimum wage hike to $15. So it's just like that, and we can't control the Republican Party. We can maybe, encourage there to be more Rand Pauls and Justin Amashes out there in the world who tether their ideas on a philosophical basis, but also with a finely tuned sense of we should be protecting the minority in every sense of the word. That's what government is here to do. That's why you have a Republican, not a democracy. And boosting that sense among Republicans while hopefully building out the vast ocean of independents, of libertarians, of people there who will be open to those kind of remarks and who will recognize that if you just have a race-based politics, it's just going to add poison to the national bloodstream.
Thank you, Matt. Quick prediction, Hillary or Trump, and what does Gary Johnson end up getting?
Hillary beats Trump comfortably, and Gary gets 4.3% of the vote.
All right. I am on record, I think, of saying Gary's going to get 5.1%. So we'll see who is closer. We will also be reporting. You will be reporting for Reason from New Mexico, from Albuquerque, from Gary Johnson's election night festivities. So we'll look forward to that. Thank you, Matt Welch, for talking to the Reason podcast.
Thank you, Nick Gillespie.
For Reason, this is Nick Gillespie. This is the Reason podcast. Please check us out on SoundCloud, check us out on your RSS feeds, and especially check us out on iTunes. At the iTunes store, rate, review, and subscribe. Thanks so much.